that I'm teaching, and I hope we can cover chapters 4 through 7 today, and then next Sunday we'll summarize the last 6 chapters in the book of Nehemiah. I hope you've enjoyed the study and benefited from it. I've had several to tell me that Ezra and Nehemiah are two books that they hadn't given a whole lot of attention to. And that's one of the reasons why I chose to study these books with you. First of all, because I know they are books that we often overlook. But secondly, they're from the Old Testament. And we sometimes don't spend a lot of time in the Old Testament. But hopefully you have gained an appreciation for not only these books, but from Old Testament study as well. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Father, we're grateful for the day and its blessings and for this occasion that we have again in this group to look at your word. We pray, Father, that always you'll help us to have the attitude of wanting to do your will in order that we might understand it better. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Okay, so we'll begin this morning with the fourth chapter. The fourth chapter of the book of Nehemiah. Verse 1 reads, "Now when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews." You may remember back in chapter 2, the last verse or two in that chapter, after Nehemiah had gained permission from the king of Persia to go to Jerusalem and to rebuild the walls, he traveled there, and when he got there, he rested for 3 days, and then he went out by night with just a few of his attendants to really get a good look, close-up look at the walls and the condition, and also, no doubt, at the same time, to begin to put together his plan for rebuilding the walls. And so he had not, until that time, he had not said anything to any of the people about why he had come to Jerusalem. But after viewing the walls at night, and no doubt beginning to form in his mind the plan that he had for rebuilding them, and we'll look at some of these in just a moment. Well, let's take a look now. Always forget to turn it on. Remember, of course, these are not pictures, obviously, of the walls back then, but they do give us some idea of what the wall. We're not talking about it. I think I've said to you 2 or 3 times, we're not talking about, I've always been impressed when I go to Tennessee, you know, they have it other places too, but I've seen it a lot there where people, when they'd come in and clear the ground, they'd take the rocks and build little fences around their property. Very attractive, but we're not talking about that kind of fence. Usually they would be knee high or maybe waist high at best. We're talking about a real wall. This gives us some idea of the magnitude of the job that they were facing. These walls, or walls similar to these, had been torn down when Nebuchadnezzar came in 586 and destroyed the city. And so, after he returned that night from viewing the walls, he then met with the leaders of the city and explained to them why he had come and what it was that he wanted to do. And the Bible says they said, "Let us rise up and build." They had a will to work. He got them excited. And even though we will see that Nehemiah had his naysayers, he had those within the city that gave him difficulties at times on other issues. With regard to the building of the wall, there was unity. They all were for that. And so there was a great deal of interest on that. So back in the latter verses of chapter 2, after he announced it to the people in Jerusalem, it soon became the Sanballat and Tobiah and others became aware of what he had come to do. And we'll learn this morning probably how that happened, because there was some conversation and communication back and forth between these people, Sanballat and some of the leaders of Jerusalem, and so they no doubt shared with him what was happening. So they even that early, before they actually began building, they ridiculed him and criticized him and said, "What is it? Are you rebelling against the king?" And of course, he was not rebelling against the king. He had come there with the king's permission, and so they criticized, and as we read just a moment ago in chapter 1, when they actually began to build the walls, they became upset about it, and at first they thought, well, we'll make fun of the people, we'll mock them. I think probably in the beginning they had the idea that this was something they could never accomplish anyway. And so they mocked them, they made fun of them. And but after a while, in verse 6, we're told that it's in verse 6 that they worked on it, and in just a short period of time, it doesn't tell us how much time, but in a relatively short period of time, because the whole thing didn't take a long time, as we're going to learn this morning. But in a short period of time, they had repaired the wall to half of its intended height all the way around. In other words, they were making big progress on this. And we'll see toward the end of the class this morning how it was that they could make that kind of progress. So, but when they saw that real progress was being made and that they were likely going to be successful and that they're merely mocking them and jeering them was not going to work, they decided something else was needed. They needed to do something like, you remember back in the book of Ezra, we learned about Rehum and his friend Shimshai, and when they wanted to stop the building of the temple, they eventually sent letters to the king of Persia and asked him to stop building it, and they made accusations that were not true, of course, about Ezra, and they managed for a time to stop the building of the temple. And so this is something they might have done, but I think they didn't do that because Nehemiah had made it clear. You remember when he came from Persia, he came with letters that he was able to show the various governors in the regions that he travel through, and those close by to Jerusalem, that he was there with permission from the king and with aid from the king and so forth. Not only that, he had a letter to Asaph, who was keeper of the king's forest. And we talked a little bit about the forest. Some think that that was the forest of Phoenicia. Others think that it was a more of a park, because the word that's used there is not used normally just for a forest, but is used more for a park, something that's contained within a wall. The word paradise, it would be the word that would later be used to convey that idea. So some think it was closer to Jerusalem. I'm inclined to think that as well. They wouldn't need a lot of timber as they needed on the temple, because the only place they would need wood in the wall was where? At the gates, you know, and framing up the gates and so forth, and making the gates themselves. So what they did, they got together and formed a compact, you might say. Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, and some of the Philistines who lived in Ashdod, they decided that they were going to have to make war, I guess you would say, on Jerusalem to stop the building of this wall. And so, let's look at verse 6. And first, we'll begin with verse 4. Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunts on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in the land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt, but let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders. And verse 6 says, so we built the wall, and the wall was joined together to half the height, for the people had a mind to work. Now, I don't know if we've said this before, but when you think of this wall that's been torn down, I don't think we're to understand that every foot of the wall was that way. There would be portions of the wall that would be in better repair than others. Anytime you have a battle like that, some of the places, in fact, would be hard to get to. You remember we talked about when we showed the slide of how he went out at night to view the walls. He reached a certain place where the rubble was so thick that he had to get off his horse and walk the rest of the way. Well, that was over on the east side, the steep terrain there coming up from the brook Kidron up to the east wall. And it had been terraced over the years, and people had built houses along there. So when the armies came there, that would be a difficult place, although they did destroy the wall there in places, and some of those houses and all that stuff rolled down to the bottom. But they would the wall would be in worse condition in places that were easier to get at, for the armies to get at, you can imagine. And so it would be in different states of repair. And so they began to work, and before you know it, they had the wall half done all the way around. Now remember, we're talking about a wall here that's estimated to have been slightly less than 4 miles. And so they are really working here. Well, so they formed this alliance with the Ammonites and some Arabs, probably a single tribe or several tribes of Arabs, and also with some of the Philistines who resided in Ashdod. So Sanballat would be from Samaria, north of Jerusalem. The Ammonites would be east of Jerusalem. The Arabs would be south of Jerusalem. And the Philistines would be out on the coast of Mediterranean, west of Jerusalem. And so these four groups mainly came together with the plan that they would make battle against them and stop them from building the wall. Well, Nehemiah found out about it, and he took action. In verse 9, he begins by saying, first of all, and we prayed to our God, and then we set a guard as a protection against them day and night. So the first thing he did was to set up a guard day and night, 24/7, round the clock, watching, on watch for them. And then not only that, at certain points he would put these guards particularly at points that were vulnerable, and then at one point he even stopped the work because apparently they were able to ascertain that this enemy army group of men were marching on the city, and so they stopped the work, and Nehemiah drew up the whole people in battle array in various places in the city. I think it's verse 13 I want to look at here. Yes. So in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, in open places, I stationed the people by their clans with their swords, their spears, and their bows. So he had his people in battle array. He had them with their swords and spears and shields, and he had them gathered particularly in behind the wall, but particularly in places behind the wall that were visible to the enemy as they approached. And so as Sanballat and his cohorts approached Jerusalem and with the idea that they would battle them and bring war against them and stop them by force from this result, when they saw that Nehemiah, that they had hoped to take them by surprise. Look at verse 11. "And our enemies said, 'They will not know or see till we come among them and kill them and stop the work.'" So they had planned to take them by surprise, but it didn't work. Nehemiah found out about it. He organized the people. They made preparation. And the end result was that that Sanballat and his people drew off and did not fight at all. In verse 15, "When our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, we all returned to the wall to work." But they returned to the wall, but they took certain precautions. Let's read about those. "From that day on, half of my servants worked on construction." Now, this is Nehemiah's personal servants and attendants. And we'll read about that again in chapter 6. "Half of my servants worked on construction, and half held the spears, shields, bows, and coats of mail. And the leaders stood behind the whole house of Judah." So different heads of houses and people in high position stood with their groups of people, stood behind them, prepared, encouraging them and helping them, and particularly helping make sure they were ready in case they were attacked. "Who were building on the wall, those who carried burdens, those were loaded in such a way that each labored on the work with one hand and held his weapon with the other." Verse 18, "And each of the builders had his sword strapped at his side while he built. The man who sounded the trumpet was beside me." So here's the picture. There were three groups. Envision in your mind three groups of people. First of all, half the people. Now, remember, we're talking about a lot of people. Various commentators estimate. Now, remember, all the men over a certain age, probably over 12 years of age, and every other man except the aged or the infirm, and even some of the women, you remember in chapter 3, helped to build the wall. So it's been estimated we're looking anywhere from 20 to 25,000 people who were possibly available to work on this wall. And so we're talking about a lot of people. And the wall was, as I said, some 4 miles in length, and they were separated quite a bit. So Nehemiah kept a guy with a trumpet by his side, and he said to them, "Look, if you are attacked at where you're working on the wall, we'll sound the trumpet. And if you hear the trumpet, you come to where the trumpet is being sounded because you're needed." You know, I started to say a while ago, there are three groups of people here. About half of the people roughly are holding the spears and the shields and ready for war and watching out. Okay, so that's about half of them. And then the other half is comprised of two groups. One, the people who are actually laboring, laying the wall. You might, if you know anything about building, you might think about bricklaying. I did some work as a construction worker when I was working my way through college, the men would come in. I was always amazed. They would raise the scaffolding, you know, and get ready, and the brick would be there. But then all of us other guys, what would we do? We had to bring them brick. We had to bring them mud. We had to bring them all this. So there were two groups, those who actually laid the wall and those who brought the materials. Now, you can imagine the materials pretty much were at hand because even though Sanballat makes fun of the fact that they're going to use the old stone. Nothing wrong with using those stones. There were a lot of stones available. They may have to be cleaned up a little bit. And the ones around the gate would be burned, and heat would damage those stones. But otherwise, they would just basically use the stones were there. Would not have to quarry new stones very much at all. But those who laid the wall, and so all of these people working together. And we'll talk more about that a little bit later. And verse 21 kind of summarizes it. So we labored at the work, and half of them held the spears from the break of dawn until the stars came out. Now, when we read a little bit later on of how quickly they built this wall, I want you to remember that. We're talking about a lot of people. I've got a new baby colt, as some of you know, and the ground I let him out on, I have to make sure that, of course, she's getting to the size now she can take care of herself, but we have a lot of fire ants, and I want to make sure they're not a fire ant bed for her to lay down on, so I'm going around and killing fire ants, but I love to kick the top off of them before you put the poison, and those things just come out, that's kind of like, there was so many people working on that wall, that's like ants, so to speak. They were not didn't need labor. They had plenty of labor. And so half were holding the spears and so forth, and half were doing the work. Okay. Then there's kind of a parenthetical chapter here in chapter 5. Now there arose a great outcry in chapter 5, verse 1, of the people and their wives. The wives are mentioned particularly. Against the Jewish brothers. So while the wall was being built, while they were progressing on building the wall, this internal problem surfaced, which demanded attention. Now, I don't think it came about just at this time. I don't think there'd been enough time for what we're about to read about to actually begin. This had been going on. But the building of the wall probably aggravated what we're about to read, exacerbated the problems that he's talking about. What is it that they're concerned about? Look at verses 2 and 3. For there were those who said, with our sons and our daughters, we are many. So let us get grain that we may eat and keep alive. We've got a big family. But we can't even feed our family. Well, why? There were also those who said, we are mortgaging our fields and our vineyards and our houses to get grain because of famine. So famine was adding to this. Famine was something that occurred somewhat frequently in that part of the country. You read about famines all through the Old Testament. In fact, in the book of Ezra, you remember Haggai, the prophet, who's to be associated with the time of Ezra, he talked about a famine. You remember we read about that from the book of Haggai. So the famine had contributed to this. And then in verse 4, and there were those who said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and on our vineyards. So there's a number of things going on here. First of all, the area to some degree may have been overpopulated. When these people were permitted to return from captivity, they were only permitted to inhabit a certain portion of land, basically where Judah and Benjamin, those two tribes had existed, and that was not a lot of land. And so some of them may have been landless, or even if they had land and houses, because of the famine, they were having difficulty. You remember when Jacob sent his sons to Egypt to get grain because of the famine. As wealthy as Jacob was, if there's nothing to buy, it doesn't matter how much wealth you've got. So the people could not. They were having trouble feeding their families, and so this was exacerbated by the famine. But also, then these people of wealth who had were taking, first of all, they were making them pledge their houses or lands, put it up for collateral, we would say, you know. And then even beyond that, in some cases, when that still didn't solve the problem, some of them were having to sell their daughters and their sons. Now, the Old Testament law permits this to a degree, and we won't have time to go into all that. You might want to study that on your own. But there were limits to it. And for example, servitude could not last more than what? On the seventh year, they would have to be released from slavery. If they had sold their land, then on the year of Jubilee, it would have to be returned to the family or to their ancestors, you know. So there were ways to take care of it. But these wealthy people, these rulers, were taking advantage of these people in a tough situation. Some of the commentaries use the word usury, which is a word, as you no doubt know, that has reference to an exorbitant. I remember there was a time in our history in this country when there were people who would loan money. You know, we'd refer to them as loan sharks, who would loan money at an exorbitant rate. And at some point, the government put some limits on that. But these people were, they were taken advantage of and in a bad way. And so in verse 5 says, "Now our flesh is as the flesh of our brothers, and our children are as their children." In other words, we love our children. We appreciate, we want to care for our children just like they do. We have the same love for our children that they do. And yet we're having to, in some cases, sell our daughters to become concubines or second wife to somebody, and our sons to become servants and the like. In verse 6, Nehemiah said, "I was very angry when I heard their outcry and these words. And I took counsel with myself, and I brought charges against the nobles and the officials. And I said to them, 'You are exacting interest, each from his brother.' And I held a great assembly against them." The Old Testament law forbade, in most instances, the charging of interest to a fellow Jew. And they were not only charging interest, they were doing it, charging an exorbitant amount of money. Okay? Where are we? Okay. So in verse 9, "The thing that you are doing is not good. Ought you not to walk in the fear of our God and to prevent the taunts of the nations of our enemies?" In other words, there are at least two good reasons why you need to stop doing what you're doing. First of all, you need to have fear of God. You need to follow the teaching of God's law and not do this. It forbids you doing what you're doing. And not only that, you need to think about your example before the nations. These Jews were selected by God to be God's witness in this world. And as he sought to bring about the means of salvation of sinful man. And so he said, you need to think about all this. "Moreover, I and my brothers and my servants are lending them money and grain." The idea is for no interest. He's using himself and those who work closely with him as an example of what should be. We see the need, and we're helping those who are in need, and we're doing it without lending. That's what you should do. "Return to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive orchards, their houses, and the percentage of money, grain, wine, and oil that you have been exacting from them." And they said, "We will do." I'm trying to look for the verse. Here it is. Verse 7. I took counsel with myself and I brought charges against him. I read the first part of that. And I said, you are exacting interest from your brothers. And then notice this. I held a great assembly against them. So apparently when he talked to them face to face and rebuked them for what they're doing, he didn't get much progress. So he decided to do something else. He then called an assembly of all the people. And with all the people together and the pressure that would bring upon these men, you know, he was able to get them to say, okay, we're willing to give this back. But Nehemiah wasn't born, Allen, who is one of the lawyers of Beasley Allen. He's one of the graduates of our law school, one of the early graduates of our law school when it was a night school. And I've heard him speak before. And on one occasion, he was speaking to this big assembly of people. He said, now, I went to school at night, but it wasn't last night. So Nehemiah may have gone to school at night, but it wasn't last night. He knew what was going on with these people. And even though they, under the pressure, peer pressure that was brought to bear when he brought this matter to the assembly, even though they said, okay, we'll do this, we'll get, he said, he made them do what? He made them take a vow. He brought the priest in and he made them vow. And of course, the Jews, as we should all do, but the Old Testament made it very serious for one to break their vow. And so he had them to vow that they would give the reverse what they had been doing. Any questions or comments on this before we're going to run out of time here in just a minute? All right, chapter 6. Now when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arab and the rest of our enemies heard that I had built the wall and that there was no breach left in it, although up to that time I had not set up the doors of the gate. So here at the beginning of chapter 6, the wall is complete, except for the fact that the gates are not yet set up. And so Sanballat and his group realize now that they've lost the battle as far as building the wall, and their last hope, they tried to think of. So now they turn to intrigue and trickery. Well, what do you mean? Well, first of all, in the next few verses, you'll read that Sanballat and Geshem invited Nehemiah to come out and have parley with them. He come to Ono. Ono was about 25 miles north of Jerusalem. Come up here and let's sit down together and talk about this. Well, again, Nehemiah suspected what was going on, and he said in verse 2, but they intended to do me harm. And so he wouldn't go. He said, I'm doing a great work, verse 3, and I cannot come down. Why should I stop while I leave it and come down? So then four times they did this, probably changing the place. Well, if you can't meet us there, come here. If you can't meet us here, go there, whatever. But on the fifth time, they sent to him by means of an open letter. Now, an open letter just simply meant that the general public would know what was in that letter. Kind of like, you know, when Hezekiah, when Sennacherib moved against Judah and he sent his general or whatever to speak to the men on the walls and listen to them, you know. He read the letter that everybody on the wall could hear. So the people knew what he was suggesting here. And he accused him in this letter. He said, we know what you're up to. You're wanting to become king. You're wanting to rebel against Persia. You want to make yourself king. We've heard about that. You've got prophets out here, he said, speaking in your name and so forth. Well, of course, Nehemiah didn't fall for that. He said, that's not true. That's just a figment of your imagination. You're making these things up, and I'm not going to fall to that. So then Then they take another, they try something else. A man by the name of, verse 10. Now when I went into the house of Shemaiah, the son of Delaiah, the son of Mehetabel, who was confined to his home, he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you, and they are coming to kill you by night. But I said, this man Shemaiah seems to have been, verses 11 and 12, read together, seems to have been both a priest and a prophet, or claimed to be a prophet. We're going to see what kind of prophet he was. He actually had hired himself out, verse 12, to Sanballat and Tobiah, and he had agreed to this plot that he was going to do something to defame Nehemiah. Now, he was a priest, and he was, in verse 10, he says he was confined to his home. At this particular time, he had in some way become unclean and was unable to enter the temple. He was going through a period of purification, but he's suggesting, I'm willing to even put myself at risk by going into the temple when I'm not supposed to be there. I'm not purified to be there, but I'll go in with you. And he's talking about the holy place, not the most holy place. And we'll remain there overnight, and you'll be able to avoid being killed. Well, Nehemiah saw through this. He asked him two questions. He said, should someone like me? I'm the leader of these people. Should I do this? Should I run and hide? And not only that, should I go inside the temple, which is forbidden of a lay person? And so in verse 12, we learn, and I understood and saw that God had not sent him. How did he know that? Because he had sense enough to know that God would not have someone ask him to do something that was forbidden by the law. You remember Balaam? These people came to him and said, we want you to come. And he said, I can't go. And he sent more people with more promises and gifts. And he said, well, I can't go, but you stay here tonight and I'll see what more the Lord has to say. You know, what more could the Lord say? He'd said no. You know, Lori Morgan has this song that I used to enjoy hearing her sing. What part of no don't you understand? So what part of no did Balaam not understand? I mean, and this prophet, if he were a real prophet, would have known that God would not ask someone to do something contrary to the law. So he figured that out. And then, he didn't do that. And then he mentions Noada, a prophetess, a woman prophet, who also, he doesn't specify what she had done, but she also in some way tried to trick him into doing something wrong. So he was not tricked by any of that. Look at verse 15. So the wall was finished on the 25th day of the month of Elul in 52 days. The wall was finished in 52 days. Now, what's the guy's name that's a historian? Josephus. Is that right? Josephus. I just have these glitches more and more frequently. Josephus says that it took 2.5 years to build the walls. And it's not surprising that many of the modern critics except that, you know, some of them even are so bold as to add at the end of that verse, after 52 days, they add the phrase, and 2 years. Why? Simply because they just don't think it's possible. And so if they don't think it possible, it must not be right. And so they just feel free to change the scriptures anytime. And I'm sorry if I sound negative, but I feel that way about people like that. Anyway, So it's not at all out of the realm of possibility that it was finished in 52 days. All right. So in the month of Nisan, he met with the king and got permission to go first of the month. Probably took him a week or two to make arrangements to go. So let's say he left in the middle of the first month. We've learned from Ezra and other passages that trip would have taken probably slightly less than three months. So he leaves the middle of the first month. He arrives roughly the middle or early part of the fourth month. He rests for 3 days. He then goes out and looks at the wall. Then he meets with the people, tells them while he's here. It shares with them his plan. They begin to organize the work details and he puts the people to work. And so that would probably take most of the rest of the fourth month, and then take 52 days from that would put you right at the time that's mentioned here, the sixth month, with 10 days to 2 weeks to spare for some that plan to be. They built the wall in 52. How'd they do that? Well, remember, there's the length of the wall, if you estimated it at slightly less than 4 miles. You remember when we read chapter 3, we saw that there were 38 to 42, depending on how you interpret some of the verses, work details. That many work groups that were assigned. You remember that were assigned different places around the wall. It's been, okay, let me summarize it. If you had, let's just say you had 40 work details, with that much area, they would have to, each group would have to do about 150 yards in 52 days. Do the math, that's about 3 yards a day. Folks, like this. Now, I know it's a big wall in places. And remember, in some places, it was in worse shape than others. And we saw some of the people finish theirs early and went to help some of the others, you know. But each group would be working, and with all of those workers, maybe 150 or 200 people in each work detail. I mean, they'd be almost stumped. They had plenty of people working, and they worked from when? Well, they had people standing guard to keep them safe, and they worked from daylight till dark for 52 days. And the wall was built. And don't you know it must have been a source of great joy to Nehemiah. You remember how distressed he had been when he learned from his brother Hanani that about the condition of the wall, and how he wanted to go back, and how he took his life into his hands to go into the king and ask him permission to go, but he had been permitted to go. And now to see the task done, and yet he wasn't looking for personal accolades. He knew it was God who had done this. He knew it was God. And he tells about, he says, for they, look at verse 16. And when all our enemies heard of it, all the nations around us were afraid and fell greatly in their own esteem. For they perceived that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. Nehemiah doesn't say they perceive that I'd done this. They were intimidated by what I'd been at. No, that's not what he said. That this work had been accomplished by our God. They knew that. Nehemiah knew that. And so he gives God the credit. And he rejoices along with the people. Now, the seventh chapter, we'll be only able to say this. Let's read just real quickly. And when the wall had been built, I had set up the doors and the gatekeepers and the singers. He had assigned all these work things to the different groups of people. I gave my brother Hanani the governor of the castle. This word governor is used variously. This is just various levels of rulership. And I said to them, let not the gates of Jerusalem be open until the sun is hot And while they are still standing guard, let them shut the doors with bars and so forth. Look at verse 4. And the city was wide and large, but the people were in it were few. Now, verse chapter 7, this is all that's in chapter 7. He tells it, he's finished the walls, they've even put up the gates, but there are just a few people living in Jerusalem. It needs more people. And so this tells about his plans to bring more people into the city of Jerusalem. It needs to be more people there. And so his plan is to take a census of sorts to see where people are living and how many in different areas. And as he began to think about that process, he finds the genealogy that Zerubbabel left, that we read about, you remember, in Ezra. And so he probably just lifts that genealogy from the record, wherever it was kept, and sits it down, because beginning at about verse 6 or 7 here, it's exactly the same genealogy. And so he kind of uses that as a guide. This is how many people came originally, and then his own personal. In chapter 11, he lists his own personal census, and using those two things together, they decide upon the plan of one in every 10 from all the people in all the areas would be chosen by lot to come to Jerusalem to live. Okay? So that's where we are, and we'll summarize the last chapters next week. Thank you.